Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene our monthly meeting of the Science Forum. We've gathered a panel of science experts here to respond to your questions and comments. You can tweet us if you wish at WAMC Vox Pop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio. Or you can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, WAMC.org/VoxPop. And then again, you could call. It's a call-in show. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number on the Science Forum. Now, without further ado, let's meet our panel of experts.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Michael Murphy. I'm a biologist and ethicist from SUNY Cobleskill. And this time of year, I'm enjoying the solitary ground bees that are emerging and thinking about honeybees and emerging ticks.
And we'll talk about maybe colony disorder at some point later in the program.
That'd be super.
And who else is here?
Nancy Slack. I'm glad to see you, hear you. I'm from the Sage Colleges, and I'm an ecologist.
What interests you lately, Nancy?
Well, I thought some of you might have heard about the attempt to bring back some species that are now extinct, but recently so. Probably we can't bring back dinosaurs. It's more than 60 million years, and there's not good DNA. But there were two cases reported recently, one group trying to bring back a mammoth, you know, the woolly mammoths.
I saw
which are
that, yes.
Only fairly geologically in time extinct. And another that was trying to pick out passenger pigeons. And actually, although other people are working on getting whole DNA, the whole animal DNA, these two groups were actually trying to put genes into related or animals, like an elephant, put genes for much more hair onto an elephant, and changing the tail of one of the other living pigeons into one like a passenger pigeon. And even if these are successful, they really won't be the same species. But also from an ecological point of view, you know, there were millions of passenger pigeons flying around the United States not too long ago before people hunted them out. And don't know exactly how they'd fit into ecosystems if we did have thousands of them here again.
So interesting questions that go beyond science at this
right.
point. All right. And who is our final scientist here?
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist at GE Global Research.
Jim, what's interesting you lately?
Well, lately I've been working on problems of how to predict how long things will last in outdoors and in hostile environments.
Can you give me an estimate on my career?
I'll give you the one answer that I always give, which is always correct, and it depends.
Well, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Noncommittal. Well, the phone lines are jammed here. If you hear someone hang up, give a call. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Dan in Great Barrington. Dan, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about dominant and recessive genes.
Okay.
And I want to know, how does the embryo, I guess, know which one to choose? What makes it dominant and what makes it recessive?
All right, Mike first.
Yeah, by definition, the dominant gene is always the gene that's going to be expressed. So if you have a simple pairing of genes where you have one allele on one chromosome that's dominant and the other one's recessive, if it's a very simple relationship, then that one will be expressed. Now, there are much more complicated phenotypes, that meaning how we look, that where you can get blending of those two genes, but always by definition it's the one that's chosen.
But how does the embryo know which one is dominant?
By the DNA code itself. The code itself, usually the dominant form, not always, but usually the dominant form is the wild form or the most common form. The other form is usually a mutation that has occurred at some point. And the mutation rarely is expressed. So it's in the code itself that tells you which one will be expressed.
But the embryo doesn't itself know. But for example,
yeah.
With a gene for brown eyes or the gene for no brown pigment, people with blue eyes, if you have the father contributing one and the mother, the egg and the sperm, contributing the other, if one is brown and one is blue, I'm just calling it blue for the sake of talking about it, The brown is going to be the dominant, the gene for making dark pigment. But the next generation, if two, they're called heterozygotes, if they have one of each, those two have a baby, it might very well be blue eyes because there is from each patient parent a blue-eyed gene in there. Mm. And our first, my husband and I have brown eyes, and our first two children both had blue eyes. So, you know, this does happen.
Okay. Dan, thank you.
All right, thank you.
1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Let's go to Ashley in West Hampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll make it brief. We recently cleared the lot around our house of about 35 cord of wood, so it was a mix of pine and maple, and we did it right before the sap rose for the season. But now we're noticing, I believe it's on all the maple trees, where the sap has seeped out of the stump. They look like this orange creamsicle substance is covering the stump, and it's like bubbling and oozing, and it almost looks fungal to me. But I'm more concerned, number one, what it is, and also if it's harmful for our very curious 5- and 7-year-old girls who obviously are tactile and want to touch it and see what it is.
Good question. Okay.
Well, I don't know that I know, actually. The one thing I do know, I'm sure it's not poisonous or anything, no reason to not touch it, whatever it is, but there is sap that seeps out this time of year because squirrels are very adept at cutting off pieces of bark. And so the sap runs down from the top of the tree and gets in a quite, it can cover the bases sometimes, and then actually birds even come and get the sap on the tree. I don't know. I haven't seen a case just like yours, though.
How bright orange is it?
It's honestly the color of an orange creamsicle. You can pick them out really easy in our brown leaves. It's just our whole hillside is dotted with orange stumps.
So it could actually be a fungus. There are a lot of fungi that actually have pigment, either their own pigment, which is more rare, or they're associated with a pigmented bacteria. But it could very well be a fungus, or even, Nancy, do you think it might even be a slime mold?
It could be, but that sounds like an awful lot of slime mold.
It sounds like an awful lot, right?
I would suggest perhaps taking a piece of it into the cooperative extension downtown and see. I mean, if it's something that's going to harm your trees, they'll know about it.
And what Nancy was saying in terms of it not being dangerous to touch is true. I wouldn't eat the thing, though.
No.
That's always a good plan.
That is a good plan.
As much as it looks like a creamsicle.
Thanks, Ashley.
And that's our fear, so thank you very much.
Not too tempting, I think.
Let's go to George in East Hampton, Mass. George, you're up.
Hello, how are you today?
Good, nice to have you here.
I have a question about astronomy. Our sun, a yellow dwarf star, has a Goldilocks zone, which is where our planet lives. I'm wondering if a much larger, much hotter star, like a blue-white Sirius star, would also have a Goldilocks zone, and how far out it would have to be.
Sure. It'll have a Goldilocks zone, but it will be a little further out than where we are from our sun.
Do you have an approximation, say, around the orbit of Jupiter or something? Would it have to be that far out given how hot and...
Off the top of my head, I have no idea.
Why is it called a Goldilocks zone?
Because just right. Not too hot, not too cold.
Yeah,
a temperature which a planet can sustain liquid water. Like, I mean, conversely, red or stars which are less bright than the sun can also have a Goldilocks zone much closer in.
And they just found a couple of those that are more or less Earth-sized.
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of star was that?
I don't know what the specific
Where's the astronomer? Yes, astrophysicist.
But one of them has a planet that...
Yeah, I think several potentially Earth-like planets, you know, within a factor of two of the size of the Earth, and
yes,
in about the right zone.
10 light years away, not too far away, actually, in astronomy terms.
I think that one is 500 million light years, though.
It's a pretty good clip.
Or no, 500 light years.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good distance at any rate. Kind of a far walk.
Yeah. Indeed. George, thank you very much. Let's take a break here, Mr. Zach. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's the Science Forum, 1-800-348-2551. More calls coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York. Historic boutique hotel offering romantic Hudson Valley getaways, 11 guest rooms, modern amenities, expanded outdoor deck overlooking the Rondout River, the1850house.com. Mohonk Preserve, New Paltz, presenting the Rock the Ridge 50-Mile Challenge for runners, walkers, hikers on May 3rd, sponsored by I Love New York and Ulster County Alive. RockTheRidge50.org for registration. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Berkshire artist Kenton Neely, showing her abstract works now through April 30th at the Dorset Village Library, Dorset, Vermont. DorsetLibrary.org. And Capital Region Honda Dealers, offering new and pre-owned Hondas in New York, Vermont, and Massachusetts for the spring season. CapitalRegionHondaDealers.com.
It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Mike Murphy's here, Nancy Slack and Jim Pickett. Yours truly, Ray Graff. Nice to have you on the line. Let's go to Bill in Beacon. Bill.
Hi. This is a question about heating cooling efficiency. Let's imagine you're having, a modern, recently built McMansion type house, four bedrooms,
all right.
central air conditioning. And it's a hot summer, like 90, 92 degrees, something like that, and you're in the habit of keeping your house at, let's say, 72 degrees. Is it more efficient to leave your house, your air conditioning on while you go to work all day and then come home, or is it more efficient to turn it off or to do something else?
We've had this question before.
Okay, sorry.
That's quite all right. It's always an important question.
Do any of us have air conditioning?
I don't have that kind of house. Neither do I have air conditioning.
No, nor do I.
Yeah, I don't have that kind of house.
I'll admit I have one bedroom unit.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
My guess would be that it's more efficient to let the house warm up during the day and then cool it down.
Mm-hmm. That's what I would think.
It would be just a matter of the time that it would take to cool down.
Right.
All right.
And, of course, the most efficient design would be to have deciduous trees outside that would shade your house.
Right, of course.
Still time to do that.
That's a good question. And I tell you what, we will when we do our next home improvement show, you can always call in and ask the engineer who will be on duty for that program.
Yeah, I've been trying to find the place where somebody actually tested something like that, and mm-hmm. I can't find it.
We have had physicists on this program who have talked about that, I know.
Mike, you don't leave your bedroom one on all day, do you?
I do not. I put it on very low at night when it's in the 90s, and that's about it. Otherwise, I don't sleep.
Yeah, I mean, if it takes 15 or 20 minutes or even a half hour to cool the house down when you get home, like, is that going to use up as much electricity as keeping it on all day? I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm sure someone's done the calculation, but none of us here have.
Okay, well, we'll have to have that as homework. Bill, thank you very much. Malcolm in Sunderland, Massachusetts. Malcolm, you're on.
Hello, Malcolm. Are you there?
Yep, hello?
Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Ray and panel. I have a question actually about getting into the sciences. I'm basically at the point where I've been computer-based and liberal arts kind of student in a way, but, you know, kind of throwing together a computer degree. But I want to go off into the sciences more. I want to do this so that I can apply real-world things to computer applications and understand what I'm doing. Sound and light, basically. But I guess what I'm a little bit afraid of is, you know, are they going to whale me with the math? Are there ways you can suggest that I, you know, certain fields that I move towards that they're, you know, not going to make me kind of, I don't know, learn just so much that I'll be overwhelmed, but still be able to apply some of the physics.
Science without math. All right. Well, that's a good
do
one.
You already well, have a degree of some sort?
I'm about to have. I'll be finishing my degree in the spring here. So
one of the best fields that I can recommend as a biotechnologist is the field of bioinformatics, and.
Okay.
It uses a tremendous amount of computing. And actually, there's a website that you can explore. It's called NCBI, And if you Google that, you'll come to that site, the National Center for Biotechnology Information.
Okay.
And they will give you a link to a bioinformatics tutorial. But what you would need is a basic biology background.
Yeah.
And then you would apply your computer skills essentially to looking at algorithms applied to genomes and proteomes. These are really quite an emerging field, and very, very few biologists have that combination of both biology and advanced computing. And it sounds like you'd be an ideal candidate for that.
Very interesting.
Another alternative is to go to, I guess you're in this area, to SUNY Albany or Cobleston?
I'm actually out in Massachusetts.
About UMass? And take only the courses that you think are going to be useful, starting with a general biology course. You already have a degree. You don't have to get another degree to do this necessarily.
Right.
But you could get the right background that you needed.
Great.
There are also molecular modeling applications for computers both in chemistry and in biology. So that's
very interesting to me too.
Right.
Especially modeling in general. Like, even if I got to the point where I was, working on, helping students and teachers to, build interfaces that help them model things in general. You know what I mean? I'm actually very interested in all those, modelings between science and computing.
Well, I would look those keywords up, and I would do a search for a little while, and then just talk to some faculty members.
Right.
All right. Malcolm, thank you very much for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Jim, did you want to add something?
Nope. I think they had it covered.
All right. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Pete in Albany. Pete, you're on.
Good afternoon, guys. Great show, as usual.
Thank you.
I heard a program like 9 months ago with Bob Berman when he said, rainbows cannot be reflected like in water or mirror. And I just couldn't get my mind around that. Does anyone have an idea about that?
I don't
that?
Remember him saying that, but let's throw it to the scientists.
No, I think certainly they could be reflected. Yeah. I don't think there's a problem with that.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe I heard it wrong.
And you can take a mirror outside during the next rainbow and just do the experiment, but it certainly works.
I will do that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, let's try that experiment. Thank you very much, Pete. John in Pine Bush. John, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks, Ray and panel. I have a question about alternative energy. I've been following an area called LENAR. It stands for a Low Energy Nuclear Reaction. It's a very hot topic. I've been following it for about 6 years now. So I wanted to see if the panel was at all aware of it, and to give their opinion of it.
Is this cold fusion? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, it's evolved in what used to be called cold fusion, but now there's been three peer-reviewed studies published, and there's supposed to be a very large one, hopefully at the end of this month, that's going to be released in a major journal.
Okay.
Dealing with its authenticity.
Yeah.
It's been commercialized. There's six firms right now commercializing it, and it could revolutionize power generation. So it seems to be very significant. So I wanted to hear your panel if they were aware of it at all.
I remain skeptical about that. Many of the times, they're looking at results that are kind of buried down in the noise, or that are misinterpreted, or that there's energy that's not being accounted for in doing the experiments. I've read lots of things in which, there's this miracle that's just around the corner. And in general, it falls into kind of the category that's called pathological science.
I have to say that my physicist husband feels the same way.
Yeah, a great deal, it's driven by a great deal of wishful thinking and selective analysis of the data.
So cherry picking the data.
Yeah. I remember back with the original cold fusion thing that there was all this excitement, and by coincidence at that same time there was a meeting of the American Chemical Society that I was going to. And I kind of went into that meeting kind of half believing the cold fusion stuff. And at the meeting, the publisher that had published the paper, was gleefully handing out copies of the journal so I could read the paper. Read the paper, and there were things that just didn't ring entirely true. Then there was this huge symposium that was held in the hockey arena in Dallas. And as time went on, I believed it less and less and less as the kind of the fabric of this kind of unraveled itself.
Tell us about the peer review process. Now, John mentioned that new study will be peer reviewed. What goes into that?
Well, that's interesting because I've just done four or five peer reviews, and I'm sure my colleagues have too. Where you read a paper and you're primarily looking for things that are outrageously wrong, where they've done something entirely whacked out. But the peer review it depends entirely on the quality of the peer.
Okay.
I've seen lots of papers published that I wonder, how in the world did these ever get into print?
Because how many peers will peer review something?
Depends on the journal.
Yeah, it can vary from one to three.
Okay, only three.
This would be the Journal of Nuclear Physics.
Well, that has a great title. It's a matter of who's publishing it, who the editor is, and what their editorial policies are.
John, that's a great question. Thank you for bringing that to us today at 1-800-348-2551. It is the Science Forum, as you may have guessed. Jackie in Stafford, you're on.
Hi. I have a woodpecker that's sort of intermittently pecking at my house, and I wondered if that meant that there are insects in the wood of my home.
Well, it can mean that. It also can mean that it's looking for a mate, and instead of pecking on a telephone pole, which the one across the street from us is doing, is pecking on your house. And if the latter is true, it probably will find a mate and stop pecking on your house. But if you find actual damage to the wood of your house, you better get someone else to look at it.
Is it really, really loud?
It is, but I've heard another woodpecker close by in an ailing catalpa tree that I have that I suspect does have insects. So the mate finding seems plausible.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's doubtful that it's getting insects, and it's possible, but it's not so likely that carpenter ants. I don't know how old the house.
Yeah. We on the bird show that we do every month or so, this comes up a lot.
Yeah.
And many times the woodpeckers will go for metal flashing because they're looking for a mate, and it makes
a lot more
noise.
Yes, and telephone poles do that too. You know, they reverberate.
Okay. So. Well, thank you for that, Jackie. We appreciate the call. Jody in New Paltz. Jody, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm very intrigued by the whole genetic thing that's going on that you mentioned earlier about bringing back lost species. I watch a lot of the shows on TED Talks about that. And I was just wondering, I know you said that DNA from dinosaurs is too old, but I'm sure at some point down the road they'll find some workable dinosaurs. And I just wonder if you could say a couple words about the whole moral issue of making any attempts to bring back a dinosaur, because where would it live? You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like, I think there are even more ethical questions about dinosaurs than about mammoths, but you know exactly where would a mammoth live these days either, especially with global warming. And a fake mammoth, I don't know. Someone was pointing out that they actually did take all the DNA and brought back some kind of species of mountain goat. I'm not sure which one it was. Mm-hmm. And it was born. It only lived, I think, for a day. So it is possible to do this with a whole genome, if one can find the whole genome.
Yeah. That was a very recently extinct species.
Yes, it was very recently extinct, and you know, so it was a passenger pigeon, really. I mean, there was one still around in the 1920s. That may seem a long time ago, but not really. No, I do think there are questions to be asked, and there's a lot of money going into that could be used to see that other species do not go extinct. Mm. So I have mixed feelings about that.
Well, what could
that.
You learn? In other words, if you were to bring back a mammoth, say they went extinct 10,000 years ago, I don't know the actual time that it happened, but what could you possibly learn by doing that?
Well, I just think it's something that people imagine. I mean, it's just something, the idea that one of these extinct things could still be there. Or in terms of passenger pigeons, people feel guilty. You know, maybe hunters, I don't know, any people still alive that were hunting passenger pigeons, that they could feel less guilty.
It would be hard to imagine, however, getting a population large enough to be a breeding population back. I mean, we have a hard enough time keeping endangered species going, particularly extremely endangered species going. So bringing back, you know, dinosaurs, they only have some mitochondrial DNA, these small plastid DNA. Even another organism like the passenger pigeon, however, getting enough of those animals alive and breeding to have enough genetic diversity to make an ecologically feasible population be, I think, pretty difficult.
Okay. Jody, thank you very much. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Anybody want to add anything to that?
Well, an interesting thing about the mountain goat was that the one that where they had preserved the tissue was a female. Mm-hmm. And even if they were successful in cloning that, then they still need to find a way to make a male.
Yeah, and we still have some tortoises that are alive but have no mates of the other sex, so they're not going to be with us very long.
All right, let's go to Peter in Poughkeepsie. Peter, you're on the Science Forum. Go ahead.
I have a question about fighting fire with water. And the chemical formula for water seems to contain the molecule oxygen. And everything that I hear says, well, the way to extinguish a fire is to get rid of or stop the flow of oxygen. So how come we use water put out a fire?
That's a very good question.
It's hard to take water apart.
Yes. Well, yeah, there are two parts to the answer. The first is the way that it works in putting out the fire is that water is very good at sucking up lots of heat. So when you throw the water on the fire, some of the water vaporizes, and it takes a lot of energy to do that, so it cools the whatever it is that's burning and puts it out. The oxygen in water has basically already done its thing. It's molecular oxygen that could support combustion, but it's already done the combustion thing. So it has been converted into water. It does not have the chemical potential anymore to do further oxidation of whatever it is that's burning. It's the same thing with carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the other major product of combustion. It contains carbon, which should be a fuel, and oxygen, which should be the oxidizer, but it's already oxidized, so it's at the end of the road.
Peter?
Yep, thank you for your answer. Good program.
Thank you for your question. We appreciate it. Tim in East Nassau. Tim, you're on.
Oh, hello. Yes, I was curious about dark matter. It actually is dense enough in areas to create its own version of a black hole. And would that black hole have any effect on our reality being a black hole? I know regular black holes are made of regular matter, but I didn't know if dark matter could create its own version of like an anti-black hole or whatever.
I've never read anything like that. So anything that I've read about dark matter, which always has to be somewhat speculative because nobody knows what it is, except that in order to explain the shapes of galaxies, it should be there.
Right. Well, they don't really know that it's there. They say it has to be there because gravity acts this way,
yeah.
But gravity doesn't necessarily have to act that way.
That's right. I mean, there are other possible explanations.
And until even early in this century, there were people who insisted there must be ether or other things wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
We're still doing experiments to find ether.
Yeah, so dark matter is not a done deal.
Go ahead, Tim.
The ether is what the light propagates through.
Well, that was the theory. Yeah.
That was the theory. But it just doesn't exist as far as we're aware.
So I guess we need to find out what gravity is before we can find out what dark matter is, or if it is.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Tim,
gotcha.
Thank you very much for the telephone call. We have a couple of lines open now. 1-800-348-2551 if you want to jump in. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a break and be back in a moment or so. Mm-hmm.
Support for WAMC comes from Dr. Joseph Cohen, optometrist, eye examinations and classic eyewear in historic Uptown Kingston, most insurances accepted, optical diversity in the Hudson Valley, CohenOptometry.com. The Cheese Traveler, Albany, New York, featuring over 100 handcrafted cheeses, grilled cheese sandwiches and soup, Tilldale Farm organic beef and pork, artisan pantry items and cured meats, TheCheeseTraveler.com. The Bardavon, presenting Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues, May 17th, Sheryl Crow, May 29th, Paula Poundstone, June 14th, and Natalie Merchant, July 3rd, Bardavon.org. Eagle Hill School, Hardwick, Massachusetts, a college prep boarding and day school for students with learning disabilities and ADD, featuring a five-week summer session, ehs1.org for info. And New England Auctions, South Deerfield, Massachusetts. For 40 years, an international auction gallery offering fine art, books, maps, and antiques. 413-665-3253 for gallery and auction information.
It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551. Mike Murphy, Nancy Slack, Jim Pickett are the scientists. I'm your host, Ray Graff, a radio man who doesn't know anything about science. And we'll continue to roll. Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim.
Hi.
Hello.
I got a question about squirrels.
Okay.
I've spent my entire life in the woods, and I'm 65 years old. And I've always noted that red squirrels and gray squirrels are kind of like enemies. They fight over territory and they fight over this and that. But just this morning when I was out taking my morning walk, I saw a gray squirrel with a red tail. And I'm just wondering if, you know, what's going on? Are they hybridizing or am I just...
It's a mutant.
No.
Hallucinating, and I don't think I'm hallucinating.
No, they're not hybridizing. In fact, I don't think they're very closely related, and they certainly have different ecology. It probably was a red squirrel with a peculiar kind of coloring. How was it as big as a gray squirrel?
It was the size of a gray squirrel, and its tail was red.
Well, I've never seen one of those, but I have seen a lot of different color variations in red squirrels. And actually, on my property with 50 acres with different kinds of trees, they both live there happily. It seems the red squirrels eat the conifer seeds more, and the gray squirrels like the acorns.
Yep.
So they have different kinds of food. The red squirrels will eat suet, and the gray squirrels won't. So they have different ecological niches. In
yeah.
England, though, the gray squirrels, which don't belong there, they've arrived there, are really doing in the red squirrel populations that were native there. So they don't get along very well some places.
I'm surprised, Nancy, because, you know, I'm also, Jim, I'm in the woods a lot and in the Adirondacks a lot. And I have seen red squirrel populations in abundance there. And whenever a gray squirrel comes into their territory, there is hell to pay.
Oh, yeah. They're
Well, I think in the Adirondacks is a little different because they're the dominant squirrel in the Adirondacks, uh-huh. especially in the spruce fir zone. And they're not going to tolerate this one from down below coming in.
And I've seen black variants of the gray
yes.
squirrel.
Yeah.
But this one here, I mean, it went across the road in front of me this morning when I was hiking.
Wow.
It would be nice to get a snapshot of that.
Take a picture and send it to someone at DEC and see if anybody else has seen one.
Okay.
Are there any fox squirrels?
No, not around here. And they have funny-looking long ears. So,
Well, I grew up in Michigan with fox squirrels not gray squirrels.
Mm. Yeah, Toronto has mostly black gray squirrels as far as I remember.
Okay. Okay, here's one that came via email from Eric. It was my understanding that whatever they call the space that expanded before matter, parentheses, Big Bang, is basically the ether. No, yes, maybe. Love the show. Scientists?
No.
Yeah, no. As far as I understand.
Can I get a maybe? No?
No.
All right, Eric, there you have it.
Three no's here.
All right, fair enough.
Nope, nobody believes in the ether anymore.
On we go to the phones again. Bob in Cambridge. Bob, you're on.
Hi. Well, driving down south this year, I was listening to a radio program that had a science forum much like yours. And
the
it turned up to be, No, this turned out to be a Christian science Christian radio station.
All right.
And they were trying to debunk the concept of global warming.
Jeez.
And one of the points they made was the oceans are not getting warmer, they're getting colder, because off the coast of California, if you go down 2 feet, the temperatures are dropping. And I immediately called in, and I said, well, that's to be expected. If you're getting more of the polar ice to melt, then the water under the surface will be colder, while the upper part of the surface, 5 or 6 inches, will be getting warmer. I got cut off.
Okay, well, we won't cut you off just yet. Let's let the scientists weigh in.
Well, there's one other thing I want to find out.
All right.
Can we properly use the term global warming for the equatorial zone?
Okay.
Equatorial
panel.
Okay, to the answer to the last question first, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because the best evidence of that is the loss of glaciers and snow caps from equatorial mountains. So the Arctic areas are warming more quickly, but there is certainly evidence for warming in equatorial zones also.
We're in the process of losing most of the coral reefs in the world, and many of those are in equatorial zones, and the water has gotten warmer. And not only is this not good for the corals, they can't be in water that's either too cold or too warm, but it also has introduced diseases which are doing in the coral reefs. So
yeah.
I don't see there's a problem with that.
And the best evidence that the oceans are getting warmer, besides the actual measurements, which show that the oceans are getting warmer,
yes,
is the continual sea level rise. Some of the sea level rise, which is indisputable, some of the sea level rise is due to melting of grounded ice, the glaciers and Antarctic and Arctic and Greenland ice caps. But most of the sea level rise is simply due to thermal expansion of the oceans. So the entire ocean acts as a thermometer.
Okay, Bob, now I'm going to say goodbye, but we're not cutting you off. We appreciate the call very much. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. And we go to Juan in Springfield. Juan, you're on.
Hi. My question is related to unification of the theory of relativity and quantum physics. Recently, I read about a Spanish scientist that was working on that. I'm not sure if that's called quantum relativity or unified field theory, but I really didn't understand because I'm not a physicist, but he kind of said that matter came from the vibrations of the string theory and there were 11 dimensions. Can you clarify a little bit about that?
Jim, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I'm in a little over my head here because I'm an organic chemist, but I read and the real problem, the rap on string theory, is that it has been so far impossible to do any experimental verification. So there are beautiful mathematical theories involving the multiple dimensions and great explanatory power, except there's no proof. There's no way so far to verify that any of it is actually holds together. And the history of science is littered with beautiful theories which desperately wanted to be true that the experimental evidence just didn't verify them.
But there's no experimental evidence because there are no experiments? Is that the problem with this?
No one's been able to think about how no one's been able to think of how to really do clean experiments to verify it. In contrast to the particle physics, which is if you get energetic enough collisions, you either make something or you don't. There's ways to do experimental verification of that. String theory, it just sort of hangs out there. This beautiful theory that no one's been able to do experiments to verify.
On the other hand, in the history of science, there are times when there are very good scientific experiments that nobody thinks of any particular applications in technology for, like electromagnetism, for quite a long time.
Yeah.
So.
Juan, great question.
That might not be fun. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Carl in Somers, New York. Carl, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. My question is about the more prosaic matter, apples.
I have a few acres upstate. I've got loads of apple trees, maybe 100 of them. And only every 3 or 4 years I have apples. Yet on the roadside, right hanging over the street, is a tree that bears apples every day. And I've seen that all along the road and even down county. That's where I go to make cider. I pick the apples on the road.
Hmm.
So has anybody ever done any study on this? And no. The apples have fewer blemishes and insect spots and so forth.
It's probably a microclimate event, I would guess. Nancy, do you think?
It's all over. I've even seen in Westchester County.
You're saying that there are better apples on the road than in the... Where?
Oh, yeah. More consistently.
These are branches that are hanging over the
tree that goes right by the road.
Yep. This is probably a microclimate event, so that the tree, not only in the spring, warms up faster, it stays warm actually during the night. Yeah. Probably more buds survive mild frosts.
Yeah.
And then of course, they're resisting a lot of frost. And perhaps because of the macadam or the substrate as well, you probably have less insect pests over that section as well.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
I would say the latter, too. But on the other hand, not this past spring, but the two springs before that, we had very late frosts, and apple growers had a terrible time and hardly had enough apples. So it does depend not so much on the climate, but on the weather.
Yeah.
So I don't know what we're going to have this year.
But I've seen it. I've observed over the years. I'm 85. I've observed it over years. It happens all over, really. Huh. So there's some effect going on there. Okay, thank you very much.
Fascinating call. Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. It's the Vox Pop Science Forum. Michael in Kingston. Michael, you're on.
I wanted to ask about the subject that I'm going into in school. It's called astrobiology.
Okay.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask if anybody's really heard of anything, if it's a hot topic or, because I know you guys have this on there.
Well, it's becoming a hotter topic because of the Kepler telescope and the finding of planets that are in habitable zones, but also within our own solar system, looking at, for example, some of the moons that contain water. I think it's becoming a topic that scientists are beginning to take much more seriously than they have in the past.
Yeah. And one of them is John Delano, who's at SUNY Albany and is sometimes on this program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Maybe in the future. All right, Michael, thank you very much. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Fred in Wineskill. Fred, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if any of you might take a stab at what you might... Science is always kind of correcting, self-correcting. I was wondering if any of you might take a stab at considering what might be the next cannon to fall, but maybe not so much a cannon, but maybe a semi-cannon of science that we might find something that we've believed for a long time is not going to be true. If you've read anything or heard anything.
Who wants this first?
Well, I have to say, in the recent past, Dolly the sheep is the thing that surprised me the most, because for years I've been telling students that could not happen with mammals. So something like that is likely to happen with all the DNA things that are going on, I think.
Including dinosaurs, Nancy?
Nope.
Okay. Aha! Anybody else?
Gee, if I knew the next big scientific revolution...
Your retirement fund would be assured.
Yes, I'd be working on it and get my Nobel Prize. Yeah.
Any suspicions, though?
Well, on a small scale, I can say that something exciting happened in the last couple of weeks. For the longest time, nobody understood why ferns, just ordinary old ferns, could grow in such dark places. And somebody has done all the DNA on some kind of fern and discovered that it has a gene, which makes it more possible to more efficiently take in red and blue light. And then they chased this gene all the way back to a very primitive plant called a hornwort, which is one of the first kinds of plants that grew on the earth. I mean, that kind of discovery couldn't have been done even 10 years ago. Hmm. So,
yeah. Well, being a botanist myself, I think that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
I
guess, one area that in the most recent Scientific American, it's talking about possibility of in the next generation of the Large Hadron Collider, they're going to be looking for the supersymmetric particles, which is necessary to tidy up.
All right. What are they?
They are particles which are supposed to exist, but not proven yet.
Smaller than the God particle, or?
I don't like that term. No, bigger than the Higgs.
Okay. Is it confirmed?
Yeah, I guess it could be considered confirmed.
Okay.
So the LHC is being upgraded to higher energies to try to create these supersymmetric particles. If that fails, if they don't find these particles, then the physicists have to go back to the drawing board some and rethink their what would be called the standard model of how things are put together.
But absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
That's right. But what you can keep doing is saying that there are no particles that are smaller than a certain energy.
Yeah.
And you can keep it, and eventually the theory will get itself pushed into a corner in that the particles would have to be so large that it doesn't fit anymore.
All right. Let's go to Kathleen in Worthington. Kathleen, you're on.
Hi. I don't have a question. I have an answer for the previous caller who was asking about Grace Girl with red in the coat.
Super. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have looked into that because I have seen that where I live in the woods.
Okay.
And the answer is that means it's an immature gray squirrel.
Oh.
As they mature, they will lose the red tone.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, the most interesting thing for me, knowing that, is last spring, I saw, or summer maybe, a pink and gray gray squirrel. I mean, it was just, you just couldn't take your eyes off of it. And it was only for a short time in the summer, I guess. So they were running around, chasing each other around, and I haven't seen anything like that since. So I just assumed this pink is sort of a dilute of what would be the red color.
So if you didn't say summer, I thought it was going to be an Easter squirrel.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. But anyway, I did actually research that, and that's what I came up with, that the red is seen, but it has to be an immature squirrel, not the mature adults.
Well, if we could get from squirrels to deer mice, there was something interesting in a study that was done about ticks, which we started with today, that they're a great carrier of ticks, and when you're planning a development or whatever, if you leave at least 5 acres of forest, there'll be predators which will contain the deer mice population and lower the number of ticks. Ticks are really a problem in this whole area now to be watched out for. They're already biting.
Mm-hmm. But how does that relate to the squirrels? I missed
Well, only from squirrels to
Nancy
deer mice.
Is trying to bring the show full circle because we're down here to the last minute. Nancy, brilliantly done.
Well, very well done.
Let's talk about ticks for the last 30 seconds.
And the first 30 seconds.
Yeah. Very nice. And the ticks are biting now, and they're over the place.
And there's a very, very dangerous virus that's appearing in the ticks in the area. This is called the Powassan virus, and the mortality rate is 10 to 30 or 60%.
Wow.
So keep your socks on top of your
jeans
in the woods.
So okay. It's quite dangerous.
How do you know if you have it? Well, you die, right?
You get an encephalitis, and,
wow.
And so physicians have to be very careful about encephalitis symptoms.
And this is not something that can be treated with antibiotics?
Absolutely not.
Yikes.
But even Lyme disease is not something you want to have if you can help it.
You don't want to trifle with it. Well, thanks for ending on that somber and terrifying note. I want to thank Mike Murphy, Nancy Slack, Jim Pickett. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Zachary T. Malloy. And support comes from the Digital Berkshire Eagle, an online newspaper for news and information of the Berkshires and beyond, noinkyfingers.com, Norman Rockwell Museum, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, presenting exhibitions of the art of illustrators Wendell Miner, Ruth Sanderson, and Norman Rockwell, nrm.org, Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, arriving daily, shrubs, fruit trees, perennials, pansies, and violas ready for planting, wardsnursery.com. And WAMC Spotlight on Underwriters, this month featuring news about HealthQuest at Homemade Theater, WAMC.org. Remember, you can get our app. It's very good. You'll enjoy it. Go to the iTunes or Google Play App Store, search WAMC and install. I think you're going to love it. And that's it for today's edition of the program. The news is next.